Behind every life transformed by medicine is a story, one that often begins with an investigator with a fresh idea, an idea that turns into a study and that ultimately advances patient care. Only innovation can truly help our patients live longer, healthier lives. Hello, my name is Dr. Kristen Siamber, and I'm an associate professor of medicine at the Vanderbilt Ingram Cancer Center. This is the monthly podcast of ACRU, the Cancer Research Network, whose mission is to establish the next level study for cancer research across the major disease groups. In this podcast, we want to hear the stories behind the innovative ideas and listen to the unique journeys of our researchers. Listen in as we explore the people and ideas of today's leading translational research. Welcome to the ACRU Transformative Research Podcast. My name is Dr. Kristen Siamber, and I'm excited to host this episode as we explore the stories and innovation of today's leading translational research. Our special guest today is Dr. Tony Schueri. Dr. Schueri is the director of the Lenk Center for GU Oncology at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. He's co-leader of the Kidney Cancer Program at Dana-Farber. He's also the Jerome and Nancy Kohlberg Chair and Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. He serves on the NCCN Kidney Cancer Panel, Kidney Can Board, the NCI GU Steering Committee, and is past chairman of the Medical and Scientific Steering Committee of the KCA. Dr. Schueri is a leading researcher in novel therapies in GU cancers with a focus on kidney cancers. He's interested in the clinical and molecular predictors of outcome to therapies in renal cancers. Dr. Schueri, thank you for joining us today.
No, thank you for having me.
Well, it is really a delight to have you on here. Even though I'm in GI oncology, I know of your work well because you're such a world-renowned oncologist. So I was wondering if we could start off with hearing how you got involved in GU oncology. As many of our listeners know, as I do, you are a very famous GU oncologist who has been integral in the development of novel therapies, many of which are now FDA approved and have really transformed the treatment of patients with renal cell carcinoma. How did you get your start in your career and who helped you develop your career?
I mean, no, thank you for having me here today and for this podcast. So, you know, a lot of it is just by the stars lining up. I started actually my journey at the Cleveland Clinic. And, you know, at that time in urology and in GU oncology, it was, and I still believe it is, definitely was a powerhouse. We had at that time that I was there, we had Derek Ragavan running the cancer center. The head of solid tumor oncology was Rob Reiser. We got just recently recruited Brian Reaney. We recruited Jorge Garcia. And during even my internship and early residency, I met under, you know, unusual circumstances, Ron Bukowski, who's a well-known GU oncologist, but mostly kidney cancer, phase one drug development, who really embraced me, introduced me to many folks, and kidney cancer at that time, even some bladder, were really quite experimental therapies, even first line. And, you know, I always had, and I still have, the international flair, and Ron was like that, and Derek too, Ragavan. Derek is Australian, so it started really nice like that. And at that time, of course, the stars lined up, because in kidney cancer, what we had since the 80s, the cytokine. And at the time, I was just starting my training in oncology. The VEGF-targeted therapy started to take off. And there were not many centers in the United States or around the world doing it or believing in it. But Cleveland Clinic, Memorial, and few others were really pioneers in that. From a clinical trial perspective, the science at Harvard, where I currently work with Bill Kane and others, was always great. And they did some of the trials, but a lot of the leadership, these trials were, you know, Cleveland Clinic, Memorial, Gustave Roussy with Bernard Escudier, who was an early mentor across the Atlantic. That was the way how I used to brush up my bad French when it started. And then actually my wife is from Boston, so it was always on my radar. And Phil Kantoff, legendary GU oncologist, that time gave me an opportunity because they were looking for someone that is a GU oncologist, but with a focus on non-prostate, although I did a lot and I still do a lot of prostate cancer. So the stars, lining up. And that's how I got the start, 2008. It seems like yesterday.
I love hearing the personal side of things because it was the same for me. Just the people you meet and the mentors who develop, and obviously I'm not nearly as far along as you, but there are the people that you meet and the people who invest in you over the years and who you get to work with that really make the difference and make this fun. So I wanted to give our listeners an example of one of the studies that you have led. So I thought maybe we could talk about the Meteor study, which was the pivotal phase 3 of cabozantinib in advanced RCC. We know sort of the results of that study, but I was interested to hear about how that study was developed, maybe some of the challenges or takeaways for you in leading that study, and kind of give us a behind the scenes look of what that was like.
Oh yeah, no, I think there's a lot of stories here. I think one of the things where I work, lucky to have a lot of also basic scientists. I mean, they're the guys that end up discovering things we apply. So I've been always fond of, I'm not a basic scientist, barely a translational scientist. So I work closely as a disciple of Bill Kaelin. Bill is a great guy, in 2019, just behind me here in this Nobel Prize. Bill was one of the first advocates of like VEGF as a target, that this is in kidney cancer. And I remember where we started doing that, I was involved with the trial early on. Mike Atkins at the BI at that time at the Harvard Cancer Center plays a pivotal role accepting me and mentoring me. But I remember like initially when I was with Bill one of those days, and I said, like, what's after? Like, what are you going to get targets? We talked about Matt. He asked me if I read the PNAS paper. And I don't know if you know Bill, he talks very fast. And I was thinking that he's asking me about ESPN. I don't know how I mix it. And I have to say, before the era of getting those PubMed and all the millions emails that come and the tweets with the latest paper, I was not a guy that reads PNAS, maybe Nature and Science quickly, the titles, but PNAS, that. And then so I looked it up, and it was actually an experiment in the lab using, now we do CRISPR, but using at that time interfering RNA, why MET could be a target in RC. It was a cell line in clear cell RC, VHL, synthetic lethal with the VHL loss. So, and then I started calling. I started Google search with MET inhibitor, things like that. At that time, my good friend Jorge Garcia ran an Amgen antibody against MET study that was totally negative, but there was something else. Why not using kinase? We found Exelixis was really focused and not focused on kidney cancer. And I just hounded them nonstop. And finally, they allowed a phase one. So it was a phase one drug-drug interaction study to allow a kidney cancer population. So we put a heavily refractory population that had acceptable PS, and we saw responses, everything. And at that time, small companies still, they had a strategy only around after thyroid cancer, prostate cancer, but we were able to work closely with them at that time. Also, I was introduced early enough to Bob Modzer, and we put together a phase three study. So, and I did an randomized study through with Eric Small at that time, and then George through Alliance. So it's very important also not just to take something from the lab to a phase three, work with cooperative groups, such so important. Sometimes some concepts don't get, but the community there is second to none. And now we have Michael Morris, who's been after Eric, great. So it was a lot of, I would say, chips in some basket. But at that time, being where I am, I start developing. I had limited lab experience, 1 year training. I start developing more and more just by reading, being there, but without really, I was a heavy clinician. I'm less now after my administrative responsibilities. And the study was heavily positive. And then after that, I still do bring drugs from early on. I was working in bladder to Kristen also, but we had really folks came like Jonathan Rosenberg, Joachim Belmont, before that, Rob Ross, that really did a great job, Guru Sompavde. So I do a bit less of bladder now, but at that time, it's almost like yesterday. So I'm like, oh, that was yesterday. There isn't a lot happened. But then, you know, we started combining drugs. Sometimes we failed. Sometimes we worked. Therapy, a lot of the early studies with Dave McDermott with PD-1 inhibitor in kidney cancer was next door. And then, you know, you have to put all the work first. You can't just, silver plates don't exist. Lottery ticket, never won. Despite, you know, I regularly get lottery tickets for fun on the way, but everyone. Yeah. So actually you have to put the work and be able to have that passion, but also accept losses. Being clinical trialist, transition trialist, you have to assume your trial's gonna be negative. Even they have a strong, strong preclinical rationale. Randomization is a very funny way to tell us we could be wrong. The treatment shifts, the prediction we base responses and survival on are moving target. But it's been a great journey research-wise.
I like your point that you need the preparation and the knowledge. It's not just serendipity. It doesn't just fall in your lap, but you need to work hard for that. And also to remind us, which I think is encouraging to a lot of junior investigators, that a lot of what you do is not going to succeed. And that's okay. And you still need to keep working at it anyway. So that's encouraging. Do you have any other advice for people just starting out, clinical investigators or others, in terms of what you would recommend looking back at how your career has evolved?
I think they have to define what clinical investigator is. The definition at our place is different than your place. Sometimes
yes.
It's like, what do you do every day?
Yes.
And I think it's becoming almost near impossible. You really have to have your work and as priority to be able to marry together clinical care. You have to have a good support system. You have to adopt the culture of the place. If you think you could change the culture of a place, think again. Sometimes it's really hard because cultures are years and sometimes centuries in the making. You have to be able to do the clinical, to be able to do translational research, and now administration is becoming hard. So you're as strong as your team and as strong as you can delegate and trust folks. But I think the biggest part of my job is picking the right people around me, because that's what you cannot compromise on. And it's always a work. I've done a lot of things that don't turn out well. I've done things that I think turned out well, but I didn't think they would turn out well, took some risk. But I think growth is very, very, very important. I don't call them mistakes. I think, you know, you learn from everything. And I'm never, I would say, settled. That's me. Like, you always like, what's going on? What is next, et cetera? Especially around this time, Kristen, this time of holidays, in a way. I think everything after Thanksgiving, I call it holiday times till the new year. With the new gym membership, that's always how the holidays end with me as the gym membership. New gym membership is when you start losing patience and having rough conversation around the holiday times. That's actually probably one of the worst feelings. So the holidays are mixed feelings for me. Great, the kids, et cetera. You're with the family. Of course, the travel is down. Usually for work, but then losing patient out that time is tough. Research-wise, the field move altogether. There isn't one person that moves the field. I think, and you know, you could be multi-talented, but doing everything, the last person I heard that was good in everything was Leonardo da Vinci. He was a physician. He was an astrophysicist or something.
I think so, yeah.
painter, a sculptor. He did many things, but at that time, I would say the knowledge was not like now. And absolutely, he was extremely gifted. But currently, this is harder and harder. It's a team, and you have to, as much as possible, mentor the team and find ways and be patient, which is, of course, not easy, and not everyone can do it or want to do it. It's not about can, want to do it. There's a lot of exceptional people that can do it and decide not want to do it. And that's totally fine.
When it comes to geo-oncology, what are you excited about therapeutically? What do you think are the next big things, or what are you excited to work on?
Yeah, let's start one by one. So let's take actually the easiest one. I think the testis cancer. I think many of the testis cancer are curable. On one spectrum is how to give less and monitor patients, because a lot of the prostate cancers are curable with salvage therapies. And second, when you have poor risk prostate cancer, how to escalate. A new target, I'll leave it for another time, because many of us, including myself, we have tried immune checkpoint inhibitor and others as target, nothing worked out. But you have to have a multi-D team, great surgeon, you know, it's multi-D by excellence. So that's one. I think bladder cancer, second, a lot of things are changing. The combo of immune checkpoint inhibitor, chemo together have not panned out, but the antibody drug conjugate, we have two and several will be coming. Their combos to make a chemotherapy, a platinum-free combo are working there. Also, bladder cancer is one of the diseases in geo-oncology where you could have targets like a bit to a lesser extent than kidney is, than lung cancer. Of course, not like that, but I think the story of FGFR3 alteration is, you know, despite the responses that are not durable but much, but it's good. I think prostate cancer, hammering again the androgen receptor, everything has proven to be, continues to be a great strategy. In the early disease, how to not overdo it. And in the late stage disease, still how to prolong survival with least amount of side effects. Theranostics are starting mostly in prostate cancer, but other things happening, the CAR T experience, so. But we're going to use cellular therapy anyhow, like other solid tumor. I don't know what things going to happen in solid tumor with cellular therapies in general. And finally, kidney cancer. I think the combination, what we can combine, PD-1, VEGF, but now new targets such as HIF-2 inhibitors and targeting HIF-2 seems to be promising. We have a drug approved in VHL with renal cell, but we have a phase 3 trial that may read. And we have finally an adjuvant treatment in kidney cancer through pembrolizumab. And with all these adjuvant trials, we're trying to incorporate ctDNA for research. I do think this is going to be very important for screening, for MRDs to monitor, not today, but certainly the next decade, because we're going to be able to have significant sensitivity. The specificity to begin with has been good. And if that happens through multiple platform integration, methylation, low-pass whole genome, I think we could make a lot of strides in cancer in general, but in GU cancer specifically. So I tell all the fellows, they have to pick GU cancer. It's diverse. Some, you know, it's weird, like kidney cancer. It looked like lung paradigm and bladder cancer. You have hormonally driven like breast cancer and prostate, and you can be happy usually from time to time with testis cancer. So you can go in all states of mind. And we're lucky we have a great fellows at the Institute here, and many of them end up picking GU cancer.
I see a lot of similarities in GI oncology too, and just the different, obviously different targets and different ways and paradigms to think about things. But just to think about how much our therapeutics have advanced in the technology, being able to treat it over the last, I mean, since I was in training, 2009, it's just incredible. The entire field is different. And there are so many things that we can look forward to, I think. How has the COVID pandemic affected you and your work?
I knew about it a bit in January, what was happening in Washington. I had in Seattle, if you remember what's happening. And then, you know, the transition was crazy. It's amazing how much dance to the Farber leaders transitioned quickly. Every admin, every person was working from home and their computers were shipped overnight. It was crazy. So I remember the call I get from one of our inpatient leaders that they have good news and bad news. It was a page. And I'm like, I still do, of course, inpatient tending. And it's like, look, the bad news, you're going to be, as you know, on service. It stays. It's a COVID. It's the COVID service. And the good news is we don't have anyone today, but you're the next 2 weeks on service. And I know it's the family and with my wife and the kid, it creates so much. We ran to see if I have life insurance. Not life, like what's the life insurance?
Disability and
Disability.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I was put in the guest room by myself and closed. And then I ran to Walmart to get scrubs because obviously, Kristen and David and Stephanie, the scrubs from my residency don't fit me anymore. Actually, it was funny. I don't know how I got them. They not just fit me. It's very sad how much weight, muscles mass I gained. They don't fit me at all. So threw them away. I ran to Walmart and it was like around the time thing. And it was a mob scene. That's the only place was place started to close. And I found bigger size scrubs. The problem is there were two colors, black and purple. So that's how I came to the hospital. The nurses did a great job. Like didn't have N95. My father-in-law, you know, is a gardener in a way. So he had those N95 in the basement where he gave me some. There was no N95. And I would come to the house after the shift and it was still March, April in Boston. This is not Nashville, as you know. We have snowstorms. And I would go to the garage, take all my clothes off, run and have a shower, then go by myself up. We didn't know, and we did it for 2 weeks. Then I start running. Then it was all my lab and my fellows, et cetera. You know, they all live in not even one bedroom studios in Boston. Mm-hmm. They were not leaving. I had to step up more. We had meeting that we still have every day about the state of the division. We have hundreds of folks, more than just the physicians. And I started, some people were just bored and anxious. We started doing research in COVID, mostly health service research, et cetera. You know, Jeremy Warner, now at Brown. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we put together thousands of patients. That's how I met a lot of people in the field internationally and defined some of the risk factor for patients with cancer that have COVID, then teamed up with Mount Sinai. And we looked at clinical trials and how the clinical trials number went down, then went up. And there was actually a differential disparities. Patients that were not white were taken off clinical trial. This was with Deb Doroshow, Matt Galsky, and my fellows. Then we teamed up with the urology quadrant, and we did another third type of COVID research where we looked at screening, how the screening went down, then went up. But again, there was disparities, who they went up, how many cancer cases that were missed. And this, of course, get us the stage on MSNBC, Today Show, all that. So we stayed a bit. Of course, now it's going down a bit, obviously, despite, you know, the mask is still mandatory in the hospital.
Correct.
But it was a transformative experience. I also, by the end, I put the one I purchased from Walmart, scrubs, and they also didn't fit me. So it tells you in 2 years, the additional weight I put on. So the scrubs are the best way to know how your weight is fluctuating.
Yes.
So don't buy
you
scrubs.
You wouldn't think so. Yes. But I appreciate hearing how you did the research too, to understand in real time kind of how this was affecting our patients. And hopefully we can overcome those disparities for the good of all of our patients. Kind of moving tracks a little bit, you know that this podcast is sponsored by Accru, and you recently joined the board of directors for Accru, as I have been serving for the last couple of years. And just such a wonderful organization. But I'm curious, how did you get involved? And I have a feeling it was another Lebanese mutual friend of ours who may have been involved.
Tony, but with a Y. And he's like, look, you have the profile, clinical trial, we want GU. What do you think? I looked it up. Actually, I mean, I'm very pleased, I have to say, because it's very academically oriented CRO, not CRO. I mean, one of the issues we have as trial is that the clinical trial operation is behemoth. It's too big to fail. But we know there are a lot of, I would say, steps that are not necessary. The bureaucracy there is second to none. And when you look at the phase three cost now, of course, there is a big, wide range. But we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, so what's going on with this trial that is negative? The CRO plays a crucial role. And one of the issues we struggle with CROs, I mean, they do a great job, but is the turnover and the fact no one talking, either adding another layer, no matter how good you are, a seamless operation. Imagine if you have seven bosses, how hard your life would be. The same thing like that. So I think a crew and how it's where it's hosted, academia, who knows what, the same centers starting small and growing was something very attractive to people that do the same clinical trials, I would say, not clinical investigator, because you can investigate many things. And it's been so far a great journey with many people I consider friends.
Thanks. We're so glad to have you a part of it. And it's been a wonderful organization for me to be involved with too over the last few years. And just the people and the fact that you can combine the academic and community sites and really get good research done in a streamlined way is really, I think, some of its real high points. So as we're finishing with this podcast episode, Tony, tell me, number one, so we're recording this in the middle of the World Cup. So tell me, who's your team and what has been the biggest surprise so far in the tournament?
Oh, my God. do you realize we're doing this podcast in the middle of the World Cup? And suddenly I had so many people as friends I lost in the World Cup, new friends. So my team is, of course, the United States. And I've been involved. We are season ticket holder for the New England Revolution. Where Foxborough is 10 minutes, 15 minutes away. Mm-hmm. They do very well. And Foxborough, where place where Tom Brady used to play. That's what.
Oh, yes. My husband is a Patriots fan and a Rhode Islander. I know all the New England sports.
I've been trying to convert people there. I have not been very successful. I have a couple of faculty, Jake Bershock, others. I've been doing a lot of soccer taunting with my European friends, and it's getting very, very ugly on the field. The French keep winning. But in this World Cup, the U.S. is doing a great job. You can't predict who's going to win. It's going to be a tough one.
It's really exciting. Even I'm not typically a soccer fan, but you can't help but watch. It's really exciting. And finally, when you're not working or watching World Cup action, what do you like to do in your free time? Any books that you're reading?
I enjoy spending time with my family, but they don't always enjoy time spending with me. I have a 13-year-old teenager, wonderful, but it's more about other things. And I wanted to talk how their day was, and there's eyes rolling, and I'm trying to connect with them. But I usually connect over soccer. Both play soccer in clubs every day, 6 days a week.
Wow.
Or basketball, so it's good. And vacation, mostly, I have to say, sometimes we go to Beirut just to see my parents there. It hasn't been consistent. We enjoy short vacation. Like, we can't go, 1 week to Aruba. We all of us, the four of us, don't like that. We like 2 days at the Cape or 2 days skiing, short things. Everyone, the four of us, I have a 13 and 11, are very much involved in their school activities. I've been reading more than before, more than my residency fellowship, and especially on the planes. I think some of the books, I read different things that have nothing to do with each other. So politically, I come from a very turbulent region. One of the interesting books that really I knew most of it, but put together in a beautiful way was The Black Wave. It's Kim Wattas, who's Lebanese-American, very well. It's just politics of the Middle East, the rivalry between Iran, Saudi Arabia, others. Very well done. Novels, yes, intense novels. So don't need to tell you about The Alchemist, but I reread it the past 2-3 years, new things. I read for the first time Love in the Time of Cholera, and like how intense love can be and have multiple forms. And currently the book now I'm reading, I don't read 2-3 books. I used to do that at the same time. I'm reading Malcolm Gladwell books. Actually, he has a new one from last year I haven't read, but I'm reading them in reverse order. And I'm almost done with The Tipping Point. So I read all of them quickly. He's a wonderful, wonderful writer. He's able to write things different, thoughtful. Actually, one of the books you should read, actually a quick, I read it during our 3-day Cape on the beach. It's just transformative. It's called, it's a bit, The Subtle Art of Not Giving an F.
Yes,
actually, Mark Manson,
haven't read it yet.
And this was his reaction against all these books and meditation that are self-improvement. You know how much this is business. This is actually, it's a very practical book. And I read it twice now. And it's good. I think he has another book around that. Usually the second books are not. It's always the first. I'm gonna get and on the plane. So it's good. Since COVID, all these.
Yeah, I just got his book, The David and Goliath by the Underdogs.
So actually, this is probably one of the best. And, you know, you don't have any Davids, but the people, I mean, the example he gave of someone that really has issues, is not able to see, but is the best wine tasting person. What did they do extra? Or someone, how much these people are filtered to be better and overcompensate, and how much, he's a guy that put things in a different way and certainly one of the best thinkers.
Well, this has given me a lot to think about, and our listeners too. I really enjoyed our conversation, and thank you so much for joining us today. And thanks to our listeners for reaching out and joining us as well.